If we'll remember from our first week, all the way back to the first week, so which I'm sure you remember like it was yesterday, we talked about God creating man in His image, those images being fruitful, multiplying, flourishing over the world, both humanity flourishing as well as God's creation was intended to flourish, to be beautified. And yet, we see that it doesn't work out that way. And this morning, we want to talk about how that story unfolds and then how we are to understand a pretty major theme in this particular story, the theme of exile. We've talked about that some, but we want to point in particular to kind of that last exile of the Old Testament, hopefully, if we can get there this morning. Well, let's just jump into it. You remember that, what was the original command to Adam and Eve? They were to do what? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it, right? And as they did that, the kingdom of God would spread. We saw that they were both a kingly line, right? They're to rule and to subdue, but they were also what kind of line? What else was mankind? Not just kings, but priests, right? They were to guard, to shamar the garden, much like the priesthood. Well, when that story gets detoured by sin, we talked about last week, you know, the sea and the sea monster. God sends a flood. Creation is undone. In one sense, when you get to Genesis 6 to 9, you find creation in the state that it was in Genesis 1:1, right? That the waters were all over the creation. Dry land was not there, and that we're waiting for this new thing to take place. And so God sends forth the wind, His Spirit, and new creation is given. And when Noah steps off of the ark, it says God blessed Noah and his sons, and He said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth." And again, we see that fruitful expansion. And then the coverage of the world, that man was to multiply, but he was also to fill, right? He was to spread over the entirety of the creation. But much like we see in the first story, the flood does not issue forth into a happily ever after. What did Adam and his sons bring with them off of the ark? Yeah, they brought animals and sins. And so really quick after the story of Noah, we see the sins, sin in particular of one of his sons. And then the next major story in the Bible is the story of the Tower of Babel, where again, we have all of humanity working together. That's good. In concert, that seems to be good. But what is their main goal? Yeah, they want to, you know, build, if you will, a ladder to heaven. And notice the language that is used. They desire to make a name for whom? For themselves. And they said that they're going to build this tower lest what happened to them? Yeah, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth, which, again, was God's intention. So they're very upfront that they're going to be in disagreement with God's desires, that they will make a name for themselves. They won't make God's name great. They'll make their own name great. And instead of filling the earth, they're going to stay put and not be scattered. Well, that doesn't work out well for them. And the next major step forward in biblical revelation is that once they are scattered due to the confusion of language, God calls a particular man out of his home country. Who is that? Abraham. And He calls this one man from a pagan nation, and He promises, "I will make you a what? A nation." Now, that should key our attention into what part of the story. So if in the garden we have a holy people in a holy place, He's going to make them a great nation. What does that tell us? That these are the people that God is now remaking. If Adam was in the first place, the holy man in the garden, and that got ruined by sin, God tells Abraham, I'm going to make you a holy nation. And that word for nation is a people, the peoples of the earth. And so God is keying in on this one man, and his descendants, his people, will be God's holy people, the ones set apart in all the earth to do his bidding that began with Adam in the garden. But he doesn't just promise to make him a great nation. What else does he promise him? Yeah, he's going to give him a name, and he's also going to give him a land, right? By Genesis 17, by that time we get the fact that he's promising him a portion of the world, right? And he even walks this portion of the world. So we have a people, the descendants of Abraham, and a place that God has promised those particular people. And we should be thinking, well, we've heard something like this start before. God put a man in the garden, and he gave him a place, and he called him by particular names, and he promised, that through him, he would be, that through fruitful multiplication, the world would be filled with images of God through this particular man and his people. Well, now that's progressed, and we see that same thing is now taking place through Abraham. All the earth, what would be the consequence of God's blessing of Abraham with a place and a people? What would be? Yeah, all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. That should remind us again of the first story of the Bible. God still, notice his main focus is still the entirety of the world. Right? God's goal from the beginning was to make his name great on all the earth, to bring himself glory through the expansion and multiplication of people, through giving them a land, with the result that they would be blessed and he would be known. And so when he chooses Abraham, that's the same goal he has in mind. He says, just so you know, you're going to be a people, I'm going to give you a place, and my goal in making you a people and giving you a place is to bless you so that all the world, the entirety of the globe, will be blessed through you. Now listen to the language that's used, though. Just in case this isn't quite convincing to you yet. How many children is Abraham going to have? According to God's promise. Yeah, so many that they couldn't be counted, right? Like the stars of the sky and the sands on the seashore. And he promises him a land that we'll eventually see is big, bigger than the land that Israel inherited. But listen to the language that's used. Genesis 17:6, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. So what kind of language do we hear that should catch our attention? He's going to make him exceedingly what? Fruitful. Where have we heard that word before? Right. Be fruitful, multiply. And God's saying to him, I'm going to make you exceedingly fruitful. And not only am I going to make you fruitful, what kind of people will be coming from you? What sort of progeny will you have? There'll be rulers, right? Rulers are going to come from your line. Kings will come from you. In Genesis 22:17, I will indeed bless you. And I'll make your offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands of the seashore. So I'm going to make you fruitful, and you will be numerically blessed with people. And then it says, and your offspring shall possess the gates of their enemies. Which, what does that mean? How do you go, what does it mean? If you possess the gates of your enemies, what's happening? You're taking territory, right? So, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and do what? Subdue it. Well, he says, I'm going to make you exceedingly fruitful, and I'm going to keep expanding you. You go and take the gates of other cities, right? It's not like, they're bringing you their gates for a collection. It means you are marching outward, right? And you are going and you're taking territory as you go. And God says, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you the possession of other cities so that you're, slowly, if you will, inheriting or dominating the earth. And just so we see what God had in mind, again, I think a lot of times, because we're reading the story, if you will, at times a little bit like literalists, or Without, if I guess, a literary mind, we say, well, it says those words, and that's all it says. And that's, so, you know, Abraham walks a particular territory, and we say, well, that's the territory God promised Abraham, because he walked it. Even though, you know, there will be times in Israel's history that, you know, they never fully possess the whole land that was promised to them, interestingly enough. But if you see the way the story is really going, which, you know, Paul is able to do, he's reading the Old Testament in a particular way, here's what he says about Abraham's promise. For the promise that he would inherit the whole world was not just to Abraham and to his offspring. So when Paul's reading the Old Testament, what does he think that God promised to Abraham? Do you think he just promised him, you know, a particular set of, you know, one geopolitical nation? He goes, well, no, when God promised Abraham that he'd inherit the whole earth, it wasn't through the law that he promised it, just so you know. And so he's looking back and he's reading the story and he's reading it through the lens that Abraham's ultimate goal was the world, not merely this the starting place. But much like, again, the garden, there would be a holy spot from which you worked. And that holy spot from which you worked, the garden, would then be a launching place for the whole world, if you will, to be taken over or to be dominated. And it's the same thing with Abraham and his people, that they would have a land, but from that land, they would go out and possess the gates of all the other lands. But notice the possession somehow is also a blessing to the nations. It's a very interesting concept that's not easy to see how that looks until, of course, you get to the New Testament. So we have Abraham, who is a man who's been promised a nation. He's been promised a place. And he has been promised geographical and numerical expansion and rule and so forth. Well, we move from Abraham in the biblical story to the nation of Israel. That's how these things develop. And, you know, we see this explicit declaration of God's rule and so forth in the nation of Israel when he begins to conquer for them in things like the Exodus. You know, when the Exodus takes place, the Song of Moses says, you know, God has done these things and he shall reign forever and ever. Meaning, you know, as they're singing that song, that there's something about what God just did that expanded his rule in this particular story. You know, we often read things, well, we know God's king and he always rules everywhere. But the story is God wants to rule here visibly through his images. And so when he conquers Pharaoh and his people are set free, it's like, okay, God's starting to reign in a particular way in this story, much like he wanted to, or at least showed signs of originally in the garden. Well, I need to be careful here. Think of it this way. The Old Testament story, I think part of why it's hard for us to fully get into the narrative at times unless we're forced to, is that the story of the Old Testament was written in a world of kings. You know, if your king wasn't great, you at least knew about great kings because you were working for one of them, you know, and sometimes voluntarily, other times not. And so when God starts speaking this language to his people, it's not foreign language to them. This isn't strange. This is the world, you know, this is the air that they breathe. So, for instance, how would you know in the ancient world whose nation was the greatest? Size, strength, basically who everyone else was slaves to, if they could reach you, you know, if their wheels could travel that far. Sometimes kingdoms were only hindered by geography. It's not that they couldn't dominate other nations, they just couldn't reach them, right? And so there was oceans in the way, things that were not as easily traversed as they are now. So the greatest of the kings in the ancient world are the ones who win in battle, right? That's how you know who is greatest. So 1 Samuel 8, verses 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Well, the reason that's important is when God, you know, for instance, wins in the Exodus, And he says, you know, and they sing the song of Moses and they say, wow, you know, this means that, you know, God is king and he shall reign forever and ever. They're starting to realize God has set this up to where he is the great king over his people. And these victories are proving that he's better than the kings of the nations. You know, a warrior is part of the king's calling in the Old Testament. And so we know that Yahweh's great, if you will, if he wins on earth, right? So, you know, not only if your king is great, but whether your God is great by depending on whether, you know, you have slaves or you are a slave. That's kind of how you figure out where your God ranks on, you know, on the mountain, the chain of gods. And if you're going to be a great king, like God says he is, you need a people, right, to represent you on earth, and you need a place from which to rule, so that from that place you can launch forward and the other nations can say, wow, you know, that king's better than our king. That must mean his God is better or stronger than our God. And so you'll see that that begins to take place, especially when you start with the recounting of the Exodus and it builds forward. I don't want to go too far down that trajectory. Maybe we'll revisit it. But if you have a Bible, turn to Exodus chapter 1. So we have Adam in the garden, be fruitful, multiply. Noah, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. God comes to Abraham, and he doesn't say, be fruitful and multiply. He says what? I will make you fruitful. I will multiply you exceedingly, and kings will come from you. So there is a shift in the language you should take note of. We can't fully get into that, but it's real important. That's why you're saved. notice Adam is given a command. What's Abraham given? A promise. God doesn't come to him and says, like, okay, Abraham, go out and dominate the world. He just says, Abraham, I'm going to do some stuff for you. And this is how it's going to work. I'm going to do this, and the nations are going to do this. And it really is a shift in the story, because we've seen how the story's gone already. Adam to exile, Noah to Babylon. That story's not working. Man achieving the goal once the fall has taken place is impossible unless God steps in and does something. So he steps in and he makes a promise to Abraham. And the next big shift in the story, and obviously that, you know, there's a lot of shifts in the story, but the next major one we're going to cover for our purposes is here in the book of Exodus. Look at Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now, what verse of the Bible does that remind you of? Genesis 1:26. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Now, what's interesting, same words are used, but what land are they filling right now? Egypt. And that's a bit of the, you know, literary irony. You have a people that are exceeding, they're mighty, they're fruitful, they're everything they're supposed to be, and they're slaves in a land that's not their own. There is no ruling, there is no subduing going on. Instead, they are subdued. Look at verse 11. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. So notice, we have a fruitful, multiplying, filling people who are dominated by a king who hates the God of Scripture. And they're in service to him and not to the great king above. And so you should be reading that as you're turning your page and you think, well, this is all wrong, right? Something has gone horribly wrong with this story. Not only are they not ruling, they have no holy place from which to establish that rule. And so God promises them that he will deliver them, to make them a people, to give them a place, in order to establish their rule, which is to establish the very rule of God on the earth. And so God delivers this people. And he does so, you'll notice, by means of a mediator. And he makes a covenant with them. And that in that covenant, he tells them why he chose them. He says, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings. I brought you to myself. Now, therefore," this is chapter 19, "if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be a special treasure to me above all peoples, for all the earth is mine." Verse 6, "And you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Now, what should that remind us of? So the God of the whole earth, he says, "The whole earth is my possession," promises to make them special in his rule by making them what kind of people? A kingdom of priests. Well, in order to have a kingdom, what kind of people must they be? They must be some sort of ruling people, right? They're kingly people. But they're also people in this kingdom that are priestly, which again takes all the way back to us to Genesis 1, right? Fill the earth and subdue it, be a ruling people, but also guard the garden, be a priestly people. Keep that which is holy, holy. Keep the intruders outside of the holy things. Make a distinction between that which is, you know, good and that which is evil, and so forth. And so we see the same offices that we saw in the garden reinstituted in the nation of Israel. But we also see something interesting in that language where he says, if what? This is what will happen to you. You will be a kingdom of priests if you do what? If you indeed obey my voice. That should really remind us of something. You know, that's just what he said to Adam. If you obey my voice, if you do these things, this will be the result. And so we have this weird juxtaposition that we're not going to fully go into in this series, but a promise to Abraham, the people from Abraham, and yet there's also this overlaying reality of a command that if you do these things, then things will go well with you and you'll prosper in the land and your enemies will be taken care of. So there's this commandment reality that's also going on all of a sudden in the nation of Israel. So they're a people, a kingly and priestly people, and they also have a place. And that place really begins in the tabernacle, where God gives them this tent, where he promises he will be there with them, present with them. And that will issue forth to the land of Canaan, a land flowing with milk and honey. And we should again see two things. God's presence in the midst of them. What does that remind us of? The Garden of Eden, right? And the land is flowing with milk and honey. And that should also remind us of, you know, the flourishing of the Garden of Eden. It's a garden-like setting with kingly priests that are called to spread the rule of God in the world. And we'll see that. The reason he says, "I'm the king of the whole earth, and I made you a special people so that my name will be great in all the earth." The reason Israel has been called to be holy is to make God famous and to extend his rule and his holiness to all the other nations. They're to be a light, right, to the Gentiles. So the Gentiles come flooding in to God's people and join themselves to them. And so we see then in the midst of this reality that the ball has moved from Noah to Abraham to now we're watching the nation of Israel. And in the nation of Israel, there's this special covenant that's made. And in the covenant, these laws are given to regulate life. Exodus 19 to 24, where they're told what pleases and displeases the great king. This is what you can do and can't do. They're told how the people of the land will remain holy, right? So the law is telling them, "You're my special people, and this is what it means to be my special people, and you will stay this way," right? But not only are the people taught what they're supposed to be like, they're also taught how the land is to be kept holy, right? And from Sabbath rest to the land, for, you know, if things are happening that defile the land, how you make it pure again. So the land and the people are being taught how, if you will, to be reestablished to what it was like way back when in the garden. We're going to see that's a very difficult task, to keep a people and a land holy. It's a lot of blood is shed to keep those realities kind of in motion. And notice the guide that will tell how they're doing comes to us at the end of the law in Deuteronomy 28 and 30 when God is saying, here's the blessings, And here's the curses. So if you do what I say, if you keep the people and the land holy, I mean, blessed will be the land for your sake. Your women will have what? What will happen with the women? What's one of the great blessings? They'll have a lot of children. Well, why is that such a big blessing? Well, again, part because the original promises, and you are going to become the greatest nation in the earth. If you disobey, what happens? I'll close the womb. You won't have kids. How do we know if you obey, here's what will happen in the land. I'll send rain. I'll send early rains and latter rains, which in Israel, as you're looking at their geography and how that works seasonally, it's very much like California. You know, I'll prepare the soil with the early rains. I'll give you the late rains that you need in order to have a bumper crop. But if you don't obey my voice, it says, the heavens will become like bronze and the earth will become like iron. What it means is that it's going to close up the windows of heaven. No rain for you. And if no rain, no land flowing with milk and honey, no prosperity. You'll see these, this kind of trilogy of things, wine or grapes and olives, right? And oil, these sorts of things that are given, they all come if the rains come. But if the rains don't come, then those blessings will leave as well. And it will all depend, again, on how you obey or disobey. The greatest punishment for obedience and disobedience is what? What's like the... God says, okay, you won't have a lot of kids, and then I'll stop the rain. If you keep going, what's the worst thing that can happen to you, according to Deuteronomy? Yeah, he said, I'm just going to pull the lease. I've given you the land, and you need a place. If you're going to be a people that are going to prosper and grow, and you're going to need a spot from which to reign over the whole world. And if you keep on disobeying, then I'm going to revoke your rights to the land, which means another nation will come in and either take you home with them, or they'll invade the land and so pollute it that there will be no more holy place, because there will be, Gentile tracks everywhere, and you will be intermingled with them. So we have the Mosaic Covenant, and the central theme is how you keep the holy place and the holy people pure. And as that progresses, we see the struggles with that, and finally the people do ask for a king. It's a long story, but God always intended that, and he gives them David. Again, so there is this, God was grieved because they asked for a king, but it's not as if, God was grieved in the sense that he had no idea he was going to put a king in Israel. He was grieved because their intentions are a complete mess, and he's responding to their reasoning for a king. And he's also grieved because he knows the king they're going to choose is a horrible one. But his intention is to give them a Davidic king. And the central theme, at least in the Davidic covenant, or what's coming out of them, is you have a holy people and holy place, and now you have a king, and that king will expand your borders, and you will ultimately issue forth into a worldwide dynasty where your king will be the best of all the kings in the world. You see this in certain texts. Psalm 89 is a good example. Verse 3, I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to my servant David, your seed I will establish forever, and I will build up your throne to all generations. In verse 20, I have found my servant David with my holy oil. I have anointed him, with whom my hand shall be established and my arm shall strengthen him. The enemy shall not outwit him, nor the sons of wickedness afflict him. I will beat down his foes before his face and plague those who hate him. But my faithfulness and my mercy shall be with him, and his name and his horn shall be exalted. And I will set, now listen here, his hand over the sea, and his right hand over the rivers. He shall cry to me, you are my Father, my God, and the rock of my salvation, and I shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. My mercy I will keep for him forever, and my covenant shall stand firm with him. His seed also I will make to endure forever, and his throne as the days of heaven. So notice we have a ruler of the lands. In the sense that David's rule is promised here to be so great that he'll put his hand over the sea. You know, basically the whole world that Israel's concerned with says, you know, you're over here, you know, as you're heading towards Greece, he's going to be have his hands over the sea here, but also to the rivers where Babylon is. His reign will go from east to west, and he will have dominion over those who are around him. He will be the highest king of all of the earth. Now, why is that important? Why is it important that Israel's king finally be established as the highest king over all the earth? Going back to what we mentioned briefly, and I tore through it. What does that say? Yeah. If your king is the highest king, that says something about your God. So David expanding his rule isn't for the sake of David at the end. Even when David is being praised, everyone knows David's there. Why? Because he's got the best God. And his God is better than ours. He beat all of our gods. And so there he is. Not only is he the greatest king, clearly whoever David's God is the greatest God in all of the world. Now, you know, this is a little preview of what's coming. You know, when we worship, right, when we declare that Jesus Christ is Lord, that's exactly what the New Testament is telling us. The Spirit points us to Jesus, right, so that Christ might be honored. And when we honor Christ, who is also being honored? The Father, right? So as we say, you're the greatest king, it never just stops with Jesus, right? It's always a reflection of his Father. Saying, that's right, I am the greatest king because my God, my Father, is the greatest in all of the earth. You want to hear all the Trinitarian implications Wednesday night. So how do you know your God is in the heaven? How do you know that your God is the greatest God, which Israel's wondering? I mean, so this is obvious to us, you know, or, well, in theory this is obvious to us, but we ask these same questions. I mean, I had a phone call this week that had this very question. You know, why would God let this be happening to me if, you know, X, Y, and Z? These are the same things that Israel was going through, right? If you're really the greatest, you know, why is this happening to us? And you've got two ways to answer that question, right? The history of Israel makes this particular thing a difficult proposition. What does it mean if you're Israel and you're being dominated by other nations? You got two choices. What's it mean? Yeah, it either means your God's mad at you, right? Or, yeah, your God's weak. It's one of the two, right? And, you know, the Mosaic Covenant has set us up for how to interpret those things, but that doesn't mean they were interpreting their own lives that way. And so you see this all the time in the Old Testament. You know, we talked about Dagon a few weeks back. You know, when the Ark of God, when God allows the Ark to be taken because he's so frustrated with the people, and it's put in the God right before the God of the Philistines, you know, the Philistines usher this thing into their temple as a way to celebrate Dagon defeated Yahweh and Israel's people. And so, and Yahweh's people, Israel. And as God's sitting there, of course, every morning they come in and Dagon is down, you know, bowing before the Ark of the Covenant. You know, fallen from his perch until finally his head breaks off. And it's God's way of saying, like, look, I am here by choice, you know. I'm here because my people are disobedient, not because you guys are so strong. This is extremely important when Israel is exiled, because that's going to be a massive question. What does it mean if the Babylonians can defeat the Israelites? What does it mean if the Assyrians completely carry off you know, those northern tribes? You know, we either say, well, the promises of the God of Israel aren't true, or we say, no, Israel did not live up to what God had, you know, called them to be in the land as a holy people in a holy place. Oh, got like 30 seconds. Okay. Give me 2 seconds to see what needs to be known today. Well, let me just do this as a quick kind of really broad brush as to what happens in the Old Testament. We have David's reign, and in David's reign, we really do see a king who is a warrior, right? And again, this isn't an odd concept. You know, David comes to the throne ultimately because there's this other warrior named Goliath, right, who comes out and he's the champion. And David comes as Israel's champion. And because David wins, what starts to happen to Saul's popularity? They're just like, well, he's great. He's fine, you know. But David's way better. You can see the trajectory of who's about to come king because of how he fights for his people. And David continues on that trajectory. I mean, part of why God says, no, you're not going to build a temple for me, he says, is because you've slain so many. There's so much blood on your hands. But under David, the borders of the kingdom expand farther than they had ever expanded. He is taking territory. He's starting to fulfill what we see, you know, in the Psalms about, you know, his hand reaching from one sea to the other and from, you know, you taking the gates of your enemy. You start to see reflections of that under David's reign. And then his son, Solomon, what do you start to see? Not just the taking of territory, but the flourishing in those territories. Like wisdom is expanding. Gardens are being planted. You know, if you will, leisure is being enjoyed. You know, education and riches and the arts, all the things that make life worth living, you know, a Song of Solomon, you know, all that good stuff is really coming to fruition under Solomon's kingdom to where what's happening? Queens and kings from the rest of the world are coming to see and inquire about the glories of this king and the God that's given him the wisdom to reign in this way. You know, you begin to see what man's goal was, not just the taking of territory and dominance, but the making of those areas beautiful and better where human life and enjoyment are flourishing. And it seems like we're on a good path, but both David and Solomon are a mess, right? I mean, if these are the, and these are the two best kings you're going to give, and we have, you know, David and the whole Bathsheba saga, and then we have Solomon and, you know, wives and concubines, too many to count. And there's a whole host of issues going forth that these are the holy people. These are the kings that are ruling in the holy space. And yet, from those two kings, we really do see at least the beginnings of what we're hoping for. From David and Solomon, or after David and Solomon, the kingdom will never be united again. I mean, think of Israel. So you got Saul, you get David, you get Solomon. After Solomon's reign, you never have a united kingdom in Israel for the rest of the Old Testament history, right? You get 10 tribes that break off in the north under one of David's grandsons. You have 2 tribes in the south under the other, and they begin 2 different modes of being, right? Israel and Judah, and never again will they come together. Israel is taken into exile. The 10 tribes of the north are taken into exile by Assyria in 722. So these northern kingdoms come, they take them away. And that's where you get, you know, by the time you get to the New Testament, you start reading about the Samaritans and so forth. Some of that is fruit of what happened there. And then you have the southern tribes who have some okay kings here and there. The northern tribes never have any good kings, and because they never have any good kings, they're taken into exile immediately. Their head is bad, therefore the body is bad, and exile is the result. The two kingdoms, they remain for a while, but in 586, the final kind of push from Babylon comes in, and they are exiled to Babylon. And that really is, you know, as the Old Testament is coming to a close, as you read all of the prophets, a majority of what the prophets are talking about are one or two things. Israel, you'd better shape up or you're going to go into exile. And those books are written after the fact. They're written so that Judah could read them and say, like, huh, God kept warning them, like, where are they now? Like, oh, they all live in Assyria. We should maybe take the warnings of the prophets, but they don't. And they get carried into exile. And that reality of Israel being exiled to the nations, all of the promises of the prophets are concerning being brought back from that exile and reestablished in the land, right? You know, so you get kicked out of the land. What happened when they got kicked out? You know, you have no territory, you have no king, and you have no holy space, right? The temple is torn down to its foundations. And the prophets are coming saying someday God's going to bring you back. And when he brings you back, he's going to give you the land again. And when he brings you back, you'll rebuild the temple again. And when he brings you back, you'll have a king again. And he'll be the greatest king in all of the world. And when they do make it back to the land in the Old Testament, what's the response? How does that go? One, the 10 tribes never come back. The northern tribes never return. The two tribes, you start to do the math on the percentages here. The two tribes that do return, when they come back, they finally, they rebuild the temple and stuff. They weep because it's so weak in comparison to what was before. And they never have a true Davidic king reigning over them. So as you enter into the New Testament, that is the story that's behind you. From Adam to Noah to Abraham to Israel to the kings. And when the kings come, there's nothing but trouble after Solomon until finally you have a nation dispersed. 10 to the north that do not return. 2 to the south that do return, but they return in a highly weakened state. And then we have, again, the birth of Christ. And so when we come back and we start talking about that in the weeks to come, you have the whole Old Testament just in your pocket right there. That really is the story of the New Testament. What do you do with what just happened behind us? That exile, as we'll see, is still hanging over the head of the people, and it's not lost on them.